Welcome back to the Catch Pitch Show, everyone. This is one of your hosts, Mike Moran, and I'm joined today with Neil Bunchard. Hi there, Neil.
Mike, how are you?
Doing well. We're fresh off our last show with Charlie. That was a blast, as always.
Oh, it was great.
And don't fret, all you listeners out there. Charlie has a permanent microphone set up, so we can have him on whenever we want, basically.
We sent Charlie a mic several months back, and he won't give us back to us. So the idea is we send a mic to a guest, they do a recording, and then ship the mic back. And Charlie said, can I just keep the mic? Meaning that he wants to keep coming on the show. And Mike and I said, absolutely.
My conspiracy mind kind of tells me that this was a long, drawn-out plot by Charlie to take over the podcast and have it for himself.
I think you're right, Mike. I think we're just pawns. Eventually, we'll be gone. It'll be the Charlie Campagna show.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it'll go worldwide. It'll turn into YouTube, and it'll be one of those viral sensations that the kids are always talking about.
That's right. It's a long, drawn-out affair that he's figured out, and we're just the pawns.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Charlie. We know you listen, so thanks for coming on as always, and we can't wait till the next episode.
Absolutely.
I won't tell you guys when it is, but it's already being planned.
Well, Mike, I keep getting notifications that you have a new knife available, and I click on it, and it's gone. Sold. You've been doing good sales-wise. What are you working on right now?
Yeah, so if you get the notifications, you've got basically a flip phone. So I don't know how you're checking your email on the go, but
it's a walkie-talkie. But it somehow hooks up to cell service because I push the button, you know, and then I can contact some kind of a cell carrier, and then within a few minutes it sends me a response. So
yeah. For those who don't know Neil, he's like one of the youngest old people you'll ever meet.
Yeah,
I envision him printing off his emails at the end of the day, and then sitting down and reading the emails, and then making little notes in the margins, and then typing responses the next day. In my mind, that's how I think you work.
That's closer to the truth, Mike, than I would even admit. I print everything out, and then I go sit in a chair and read it. So, oh my God, I'm hopeless as far as technology. I'm just able to turn my computer on, look at a few things, and if I have any opportunity, I will print it out and go read it. So you're right. It's pretty sad.
Yeah, I remember in the 90s, like showing my mom how to get an email account, and I remember her printing the emails. I know if you're younger listening to this makes no sense, but this was a thing for quite a while. Probably millions of people printed out their emails. You wouldn't dare stare at a computer screen that long. But anyway, things are going well. I'm just making knives. I've got a lot of new handle material in, lots of vintage micartas I'm going to be working through. Yeah. Lots of old stuff, some unique stuff. And let's see here. I've been using a lot of Rich Light.
And I don't know what that is.
So Rich Light's like some brand, but it's basically paper micarta, modern paper micarta. It's, whatever, recycled paper, whatever nonsense. But it's got nice colors you can kind of finish it matte. And I know some guys like bead blast it. It has a really great look. Or me, I hand sand it to 5,000 grit and buff it and all that nonsense. But it's a nice paper micarta. I really like it. It's pretty durable. It's got nice colors. So I've been making a lot of knives with that Rich Light. And then I just cut out 15 knives end of last week and into the weekend and Magna cuts. So got those through Heatree, and I'm going to start working on those probably next week. So lots of Magna cut and more carbon fiber coming, because I really, really like that. So that's what's going on. I've been chasing flies in the shop. You know, we have little insects here and there in Arizona, and the flies are because I leave my doors open because it's been nice out every day, and I get flies in here. You know, I think back to like when I was a kid in the '80s, you had like fly strips.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I grew up in a barn. You'd have them
right
from the ceiling or whatever. Absolutely. Maybe you had one on your porch or whatever. Well, I'm like, that's what I need is a fly strip. So I go on Amazon, look around, and they're not really well rated, the fly strips, but I found this stuff and I've got it sitting here. Let's see here. It's called window fly traps. And they're like these little clear pieces of like, I don't know, 6-inch by 3-inch pieces of plastic, what look like plastic. And I don't know what that is in millimeters, but you can Google it. And it's just got a little adhesive. You put it in your windowsill on the glass near the windowsill where flies love to accumulate. And man, I came out one day later, there must have been 200 flies on that thing.
Huh.
So those are really good. Window and fly
traps. They're sticky, right?
Yeah, they've got one little strip of stickiness, just enough to like hold it to the window. But yeah, the other side towards you, towards the inside of the house or inside the window is sticky. So works really good. Boom. No flies.
So my next question then, Mike, could you take this fly trap full of flies, impregnate it in some kind of a glue, and then make a handle material out of that?
No, we are not doing any of that. But I know it sounds silly, but man, you're trying to like push a file or do something and flies buzzing you in the face all the time. Drives you crazy.
Yeah.
So that's been my big thing. I'm working on getting air conditioning in here because it's April as we record this. And it's getting warm outside.
Yeah.
And it's definitely getting warm in here. It's 80 degrees in the shop right now where Neil and I are talking, and it's too warm. So, man, oh man, Neil, I know you, you're kind of an HVAC aficionado. Mini split costs are through the roof.
Yes. Yeah. Hey, I'm curious, back to that Rich Light, I assume that comes in all the different colors, artificial materials would come in.
Oh yeah. That's a really good question. So, both Rich Light and there's another company similar to it called Paperstone that I've also used. They manufacture this stuff for architectural reasons and for kitchens.
Hmm.
So a lot of times you'll open like a, you know, one of these magazines with these fancy houses in it, and they'll have like blue kitchen cabinets or something of that nature, or weird countertops that are like black or, you know, something of that nature. That stuff comes from these companies. So it's a real stable material. It's, you know, it's all engineered, of course. And a lot of people use it for architectural accents as well. Waffle House uses it for their counter, their prep counter.
Really? Huh.
Yeah. So it's used in all kinds of stuff. So why I said that is that dictates the colors you get.
Okay.
So there's black. There's a brown, there's a maple looking color. There's like a deep red color. There's a deep blue color.
Okay. No peppermint twist.
Yeah. They have layers too, like layers of color, which I don't typically get into.
Right.
And Paperstone's the same way. They actually have more options, but
yeah.
I like the Rich Light better. There you go.
And does it work when you're using it, sanding it, pinning it? Is it pretty similar to micarta?
It feels like modern micarta, but it holds up like old school grind into it, get cancer type of micarta. So it's kind of the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
It holds up to peening really well. It's easy to work. It drills real nice. Just all the kinds of things a knife maker would like. Plus, I think it looks good. So
yeah.
There you go.
Well, that almost leads me into a segue for the Janesville show.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a great show 2 weekends back. But with that said, I had breakfast Saturday morning with a good friend of mine, Barrett, and we met up with Kyle Daly. And Kyle had the awesome. biggest chunk of micarta I've ever seen. It looked like a 6x6 thick block that was, I don't know, a foot and a half long, and it weighed about 900 pounds. I don't know what that would have been used for originally. It was a beautiful brown color, and I don't think he got it at the show. He just showed me and said, what do you think of this? And I went, holy crap, that's huge. So
wow. I know that at some knife shows, I'm sure you've seen it before, Neil, like you'll see a chunk of that or something made out of that at a table, more right. of a conversation piece to
right.
to start up conversations. I wonder if Kyle was using it for that. Kyle, if you're not using it, you know my address. Just send it over here. I make a lot of knives.
That's right. There was one guy I talked to at the show quite a bit who had a table of materials, and among them were a fairly decent selection of meteorite. I don't know that I've seen meteorite in person before, but the first thing I notice is how heavy it is. I mean, it's like lead. You pick up a small little chunk. I mean, a golf ball size piece of meteorite is incredibly heavy, really dense. But he said that it actually is usable. You can cut it. They have special saw blades to cut meteorite. He said you can cut it with a regular metal bandsaw, but if you hit any of the glass inside of it, he said it'll just strip the teeth right off your saw blade. So they do make special blades for cutting the meteorite stuff. But it was kind of fun just to look at it and see different chunks. And a lot of it had kind of some of the stuff he had that was cut had grains or texture similar to Damascus, which I thought was neat. And he said, if you take and etch that with an etching, you know, acid of some type, it really brings that, grain, that beauty out of that metal. I don't know. I guess I didn't really ask him what you'd use it for. You wouldn't use it for blades, but I'm sure you'd use it for, bolsters, maybe even
inlays.
The metal handy. Exactly. Inlays. You're right, Mike, but, cool stuff. And then he had some other mammoth and mastodon. And there again, sometimes it's just fun to pick that stuff up and look at it and see the grain and even just thinking that you've got something in your hand. And the meteorite, I mean, I think, my God, how many years has that been floating through space? Where'd it come from? Did it come from, you know, 1 million miles away, 10 million miles away? And then some of that stuff, like I said, that's mastodon or mammoth, you go, there again, is this is thousands of years old. So it's yeah. just, it's kind of, it's thought provoking when you're holding a material that you know is anywhere from thousands to perhaps millions of years old.
Can raise a lot of existential questions, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So did you have snow in Janesville?
We, you know, it's funny because I went down there last year with my good friend Barrett, and we met up with a bunch of other knife guys we knew from the Blade forums. It was Todd and Paul and Harry and Jeff and Greg, and we usually meet up for breakfast right away in the morning. But last year we went down there, and it was clear sailing, no snow, beautiful. Woke up the next morning and it was a blizzard. I mean, the cars were covered in snow. We drove home. There were semis in the ditch. And then this year it's been so mild, and we thought, oh, this will be great. We'll be driving down there with the windows open and, you know, our feet sticking out. It started snowing 2 days before the show, and it snowed and snowed and snowed. Barrett picked me up Friday morning at 4:30 in the morning, which, I think whether you're an old guy or a young guy or a medium guy, that's pretty darn early. So, yeah. But we wanted to leave a little earlier because we knew it was snowing, and the roads weren't bad. But as we're driving from Minneapolis down to Janesville, about a 4.5 hour drive, it's kind of southeast of us. Even though the roads were clear and plowed, we saw numerous semis in the ditch, cars in the ditch that must have happened, you know, earlier that morning, you know, maybe 1 a.m. or something. But we got there, and it was snowy and it was chilly, but it wasn't bad, and it didn't snow on the way back. But the show again was great. We got there Friday, and Friday is a great day to be there because there's some people, guys are still kind of setting up, but it's a good time to be able to walk around and see things and get first opportunity. Saturday is fun because there's a lot of people, but there's almost too many people. We left about noon on Saturday and you couldn't hardly walk in there. It was packed, which is a good sign. It's a good thing. That's for great. Knife shows. Yeah. It is great. Yeah. And you feel good for all of the dealers knowing that, hey, it's worth their while to pack all their stuff up and drive from wherever they drove to. You know, a lot of dealers were pretty much from the Midwest, you know, Chicago area. But it was good to see a lot of people. And when you could see guys, I mean, people were buying. I mean, you could just walk from table to table and there was money being, you know, passed back and forth, knives being handed over. So it wasn't just a show and tell. It was a good buying weekend for a lot of people.
That's great. Did you pick up anything good that you want to talk about?
I picked up a couple of knives. First of all, for me, it's almost more fun to see some of my friends get knives, especially guys who are kind of newer at the hobby. And you know, we'd be evaluating stuff. And sometimes they'd ask me to come over and look at something. And it's fun to see some of these guys who are GEC collectors, or maybe they've always had a pocket knife, but not so much collecting older stuff. And it's neat to see a lot of these guys starting to branch off into older knives, vintage stuff. And you know, hopefully, if nothing else, I can kind of tell them maybe what to look for in knives that have been cleaned or polished or, you know, cracked or replaced handles. So for me, I just feel like I kind of help them, give them a little guide in what they're buying. I picked up a couple of knives, not a lot. I picked up one nice old English piece. I don't have it here in front of me. I picked up a couple of Barlows. I spent a lot of time talking with an old friend of mine, Bill Wright. And Bill Wright has been in the knife world forever. I mean, he's one of the old timers who is highly respected. He's written articles for Knife Magazine. He wrote a neat book years ago on theater knives, and theater knives were the knives that guys would make in the military, whether it was Army, Navy, whatever. If they had any free time and if they found a chunk of steel, they might be grinding themselves a blade, or maybe they'd take an existing knife and then modify it, put their own handles on it. You know, maybe they take a bayonet and you know, cut it shorter, grind it down, make a nice, yeah, you know, dagger out of it. I don't know, Mike, if you've seen some of what they call the trench art. Also, a lot of these military guys used to take shells, anywhere from, you know, small rifle shells to cannon shells, and they'd make ashtrays and you know, lamps and all kinds of things. And they just, again, in their off time, they'd sit down with a chisel and a file and a hammer and just rework, you know, a shell into some kind of a piece of art, kind of in the same vein as making their custom knives.
Very cool. Yeah, that'd be a fun little niche to collect in, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Shell art.
And I already brought it up on one of the forums, but in case somebody hadn't seen it, you know, to me, for as much fun as it is to go to a knife show, I get way more enjoyment out of hanging out with friends about, you know, and Mike, you're the same way. I mean, you and I have built such a great bond because we've been together. We've had beer and tacos together and looked at knives together and laughed. And that's the thing that really, you know, builds friendships. You know, you can do a lot of stuff through forums and on emails, but boy, it's different when you actually get together. So we had dinner with Barrett, Todd, and Paul, three really good guys. And then in the evening, we sat out in Todd's car and basically consumed one whole bottle of whiskey among four guys.
A bunch of 17-year-olds, I see.
We were 17-year-olds. And the fun thing was, is that two of us were closer to age, in our 60s, and two were closer to 40s. So we're yelling songs back and forth. You know, it went from, you know, Jethro Tull to Oasis. I mean, it was just fun because, you know, guys going, oh, you got to hear this song, it's the best. And it was fun. And of course, we're talking knives and we're talking, and you're right, Mike. I mean, it was four 17-year-olds, getting a little drunk on whiskey, playing music, and just laughing like schoolgirls. So
yeah,
there again, that was such a great time.
When the bourbon comes out, everybody wants to be a DJ.
Oh yeah.
That's fun.
And I had to laugh. I won't mention his name, but it was Paul. And after every single song that was played, he'd say, "Man, I love that song." Didn't matter what it was. I mean, and I don't know if that was the whiskey, the camaraderie, or if he thoroughly enjoyed every piece of music that was playing. But we just cracked us up. It was great. So Janesville was good.
Well, that sounds like a fun time in Janesville. And glad you guys could, you know, only go to the show for an hour or two on Saturday so you could go sit in a parking lot and drink for the rest of the day. So yeah, it's real mature.
Yeah, yeah. So you have to kind of, you know, you kind of have to weigh your valuable time.
You're only on this planet for so long.
A little knifing, a little drinking, yep.
Yeah, that's fun. So that's what knife shows are all about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And the knives too, of course. But
yep,
at this stage in my life, I enjoy the camaraderie more than the knives.
100%. So with that said, I went to another knife show. It was a gun show, but they had some knives this last weekend, a local show, and I did pick up one knife that I was just thrilled to get. I'm going to hold it up for Mike, and this is a Cattaraugus wrench knife. So it has a regular adjustable wrench on one end, and then it has two blades, one cutting blade, a spear point cutting blade, and then a secondary blade that has a bottle opener and a screwdriver on the end. It's made by Cattaraugus. I haven't done a lot of research on this. I've got to nail down exactly. They were pre-war knives, but I've got to do a little research and find out exactly when they were made. They don't come up very often, you know, on auction sites. When they do come up, usually the main blades are just ground to a pulp, you know, because they were a wrench
knife.
They were used heavily. So, and a lot of times handles are busted on them because, again, it was a tool. The tool that most people see when they're searching for tool knives is that HHH Barnett player's knife, yeah, which I'm holding up to Mike. And these were made for a long period of time. I mean, I don't know, at least 25 years from the early 1900s up to about World War II. And these were a pliers, which was pretty handy. And then they had a hoof pick on one end to pick stones out of a hoof. And they also had a main cutting blade. And then they had a punch. I'm pulling this open, but a punch and or marlin spike on the other end. And like I said, these do come up fairly often. Again, hard to find one with a good blade. But going back to the Cattaraugus wrench knife, these are much less common, not seen very often. So again, I couldn't have been happier to find this at that show and got it free.
It looks shiny. Are the jaws in good shape?
This knife has been lightly cleaned. The jaws are in good shape. Everything works. The blades are full, but someone has taken and cleaned this knife up just a little bit and you get what you get. So
it's a nice specimen for sure.
Yep. Bone handles. Both these knives had bone handles, nice jig bone. But I always laugh because I think of so many people, younger people think the Leatherman was such an innovative tool. It's like, oh man, why didn't they think of the Leatherman earlier? Yeah. Well, they did. I mean, the Barnett player's knife and this Cattaraugus knife were around, I mean, 75 years before the Leatherman came out. And the Leatherman, it's a great tool. It's absolutely a great tool, but it was all marketing. I mean, it came out at the right time. It fed a good niche. Tim Leatherman, who designed and built that company, really made a good product. But yeah, it certainly was based off knife tools that came many, many decades before that. If I can jump topics, I just watched a video with my son last week that was just fantastic. I couldn't recommend it strongly enough. And it's a YouTube video, and it was put on by a company called Veritasium, I believe is the name.
Veritasium, yeah.
Veritasium. And my son watches that YouTube, all the time. And it's really a science educational based YouTube, but really well done. So they don't specialize at all in, you know, knife, swords, cutting tools. They're just a basically an educational channel that happens to put out really good videos. But they just put a video out. It's kind of a long name. I'm going to read it off here, but it's the name of the YouTube video is how the most expensive swords in the world, I said swords, didn't I? Swords in the world are made. And it's all about the art of Japanese sword making. And it was so neat because they started out with the Japanese industry making these is similar to the Little Messers, the cottage industry of Sheffield, in that they have a group of people who just create the metal, forging the metal itself. So once they've molded or melted the metal and got it to what would be considered a good steel, then it goes off to the blade smiths who create the blade, fold it, hammer it, pound it. And then from there, it goes off to other fellows who their only job is sharpening and polishing the blade. But it was fun because the video not only showed all these different processes, but they talked about some of that, of the science and some of the math involved. And it was interesting because here you think about these guys that have been making these swords for, you know, thousands of years, and there was no science. It was all trial and error. And then it were secrets passed on from, you know, son, father to son, you know, brother to brother, you know. And you think about how these guys made stuff that was so incredible without the technology and the internet and all the scientific, you know, gauges we have nowadays to measure things. They're doing it by just sight and you know, it's like, holy cow. But it was such a great video.
Here we go. So type in expensive swords and you'll probably find it, huh?
Yes, yes. Mike, have you when I said that Veritasium, have you seen that channel before?
Yeah, I remember. It's been around for a while. Okay. I remember seeing videos on there before.
Yeah,
very nice.
And then I stumbled on, and this next video was okay. I mean, it wasn't great, but it was interesting. And then it like Mike and I always joke, you watch one video and all of a sudden you're searching for other videos, you know, on a similar topic.
The old YouTube rabbit hole. Yeah.
The old YouTube rabbit hole. And this one was on stab-proof clothing. And first thing I'm thinking.
First you're getting into Japanese swords. Now you're looking up.
I know,
you're going to have the FBI knocking on your door. ATF's going to be there. Take away your guns.
Probably. But anyway, it was interesting. This one was done by a company called Shadiversity on YouTube. And their title was, We Tested Stab-Proof Clothing. And they basically had three different items of clothing. One was an undershirt. And the first thing you look at that and you go, no, that's not going to work. And then they had a vest. And then they had a jacket with sleeves and a hood. So part of the trouble was they didn't really tell you what some of the materials were. Maybe they didn't know. They were basically just testing this stuff to see how it worked. The shirt must have been made out of some type of some tightly woven material because it was basically cut proof, but certainly not stab proof because they had this
thing. Was it like a t-shirt?
Mannequin. It was a t-shirt.
Okay.
It looked like a t-shirt. Looked like a regular t-shirt. So all I can think is it must have been some kind of a high grade Tyvek or maybe a super thin Kevlar.
Oh,
the guy did say it was pretty hot when he wore it. It certainly didn't breathe. And they tried different experiments. They did try slashing it with different knives, and it did hold up really well to slashing, but stabbing basically anything sharp with any kind of force would go right through it. Then they had a vest, which looked like a vest you'd wear in cold weather. It didn't look like a bulletproof vest. It didn't look like a military vest. It looked like something you would just wear if you're outside. And that held up pretty good to stabbing, but some problems it had was that there was nothing that protected the sides. It was only front and back and nothing that protected the shoulders. So if someone was coming at you with a knife blade, you know, stabbing downward or stabbing sideways, it didn't do anything for that. And then the final one they had was a full-blown jacket, sleeves and everything. And there again, it was a nice-looking jacket. It looked normal. Both the vest and the jacket had some kind of plating inside. Not steel. It was a plastic something, like maybe, again, a real thin Kevlar something. When they tapped on it, you could hear it. You could hear the sound of something dense inside the vest and the jacket. Anyway, I'd never seen anything like that before, and it was just, it just popped up, and I watched, and I thought, well, that's interesting. It's kind of knife related. I'm not asking for one for Christmas, and I don't feel any need to ever have to wear a stab proof jacket or a vest.
Yeah, my next question is going to be.
I'm in the wrong neighborhood. I'm no tough guy. I don't need to go fight some ninja guy who's going to be stabbing me. So I just found it amusing to watch. Yeah.
Well, if you have a Japanese sword, you don't have to worry about it.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Nice. Nice. You got two knife shows out of the way. You got another one coming up, in a week from now? We're recording this on the 2nd of April.
I think. I don't even know what date it is. It's like the 13th? The Eugene knife show.
12th and 13th or something like that?
Yeah, it could be, Mike. Yeah. I think time flies so fast, and I got to look at my calendar. It is coming up fast. You're right. So I'm going out with this friend, Barrett, who I went to the Janesville show with, and we're meeting another old friend of mine out there, Myron, who I've been going to the Eugene show with for over 20 years. And there's going to be a great turnout, I think, at the Eugene show. Charlie's going to be there, of course. Ridian's going to be there. And there's a bunch of other guys that I know, other collectors. And to me, I know I've said it before on this show, but Eugene is my favorite show. Atlanta Blade Show is neat, and Atlanta Blade Show is huge, and it's a spectacle, and it's really fun. But if you're more of a vintage guy like me, there's nothing comes close to the Eugene show. It's just phenomenal.
Hope you have a great time. I kind of feel bad for Charlie. I know he mentioned that Ridian was going to drive him down there, but
I think I heard somebody told me that Ridian was going to put a blow up air mattress in the back, and Charlie was just going to lay down in the back on the way down there.
That would be cool.
I don't know if that's true or not, but I think that was, be a little more comfortable.
I do challenge Ridian and Charlie to stop in Tacoma on their way down there and take a picture of their Tacoma in Tacoma. Send that over to me. I want to see that.
I would. Me too.
Well, I wish you good luck at the show. I hope you come away with a few good parting gifts there.
I hope so, too. Thanks, Mike. I know it's your son's birthday, or you'd be there with us. So,
yep, I'm a little ashamed to say I started booking a flight when my wife reminded me. I was going to use the word chastise, but we'll stick with reminded that it was my son's birthday. So, no go for Eugene. Not this year.
I did suggest that what a great birthday present to take him to the show.
Yeah. Yes.
So, Mike, you have an event coming up.
Yes. Since I've been in Arizona, and we've talked about this for a few years now, Neil.
We have.
I decided, why do I got to fly around all these shows all the time? And I love Blade Show, but I don't really like Atlanta. So it's not fun in Atlanta. No offense to our Atlanta friends, but I'm tired of going to Atlanta. So I'm going to make my own knife show, and I've threatened to do it for many years, but this is the year I'm going to try it. I'm going to try and keep it as small as possible because I'm nervous to do the first one. But the idea is a little weekend or / end of week, I'm not sure yet, extravaganza. It'll be a two-day event where we're going to have a handful of knife makers and a handful of collectors, and we're all going to get together and have a good time. So we'll have a little knife show. It's fairly informal, maybe some libations and some live music, and we'll follow that up with trip down to the local saloon and, maybe more libations, some bull riding, because we have a lot of bull riding around here. And then we'll follow that up with the next day with some off-road shenanigans, little desert fun, and top it off with some tacos because, well, if you've ever been out with Neil and I, we're always doing the taco thing. So we'll top it off with some tacos here. And where I live in New River. So that's the plan. I send out an email to my subscribers and got a lot of interest. So thanks all that are interested. And I haven't quite figured out how I'm going to do it yet, but we'll figure out the details in the next couple of weeks. I'm trying to line up all the knife makers that are going to come. And then we'll figure out the itinerary and the rest of the planning. But looking at last half of October, I think, Blade Show West is in the beginning of October, if memory serves me correctly, in Salt Lake City. So I'll probably, I thought about piggybacking off of that, but I don't think I will. So we'll probably have this in the last half of October. So hit me up if you're interested in coming, moranknives@gmail.com. And I bet you our friend Neil will be there. I just bet.
I wouldn't miss that for the world, Mike. I will be there. I've had the great pleasure to have gone to a few knife gatherings with friends, with makers, with collectors over the years. And for as fun as a knife show is, a knife gathering of a smaller group of guys is even better yet. Because the knife shows are fun, but they get kind of hectic and chaotic. And you always feel like I got 10 minutes to talk to this guy, and then I got to run to the next table or talk to the next, you know, person. And to have a more intimate gathering of people, it's more relaxed and you're sitting around and this is going to be fantastic, Mike. So
cool. Yeah, that's the idea, is to bring friends together, both old and new, people from all over, different walks of life, and have a good time together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe pass around a few knives.
Yeah.
So that's the idea, and we'll have some fun as well. And of course, good food. Because you got to have the good food component, or it's no good.
Good food. And Mike had already told me that there's some B&Bs nearby and a pretty good hotel close by.
Yes. So I live really close to a town called Cave Creek, which is more of a touristy town, but they've got a hotel there. I can't remember what it is, Best Western or something like that. But it is like the nicest hotel you'll ever stay in, even though it's just like a low-end chain. So we've got that. We've got lots of Airbnbs in my area because it is a kind of a destination for people for various reasons. We have all kinds of lodging options. You can sleep under the stars. You could sleep in my backyard. I'm a little nervous because the neighbors have been like posting photos of bobcats running around the neighborhood here lately. So I don't know. You know, when I moved here, I was all nervous about rattlesnakes and scorpions. And the scorpions are like the most underwhelming critter I've ever seen in my life. So whatever with the scorpions. But, you know, when you get into the mountain lion and bobcat territory, you want to be on your guard there. Those are animals of prey that will stalk you in the middle of the night.
You take roll call every night, don't you, Mike, with your sons to make sure they're all still there?
Oh, boy. I don't know, but after seeing a few pictures of these bobcats and mountain lions lately, I've had my head on a swivel when I'm outside. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But I'm ready to go. Do not sneak up on me right now, because I am ready to go. Oh, shoot. All right. More to come on the knife show idea, though. But yeah, last half of October, we'll have more details. And if you're not subscribed to my email list, you can hit it from my website. And moranknives.com, and more details to follow. So I'm looking forward to it.
That sounds fantastic, Mike. Will you be doing some bull riding yourself that we can watch?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But you guys will have a fun time watching bull riding for sure. It's fun to watch it. You know, bull riding is done well. You know, girls are doing bull riding nowadays, which wasn't a thing when I was a young man, but now it's a thing, but and some of them are really good. But mostly just, you know, men age 19 to 21, because by the time you're like past age of 21, your back is completely shot. So it's pretty comical in some ways. But
that's exactly when I rode a mechanical bull one time only, because I grew up riding and racing dirt bikes and street bikes, and I thought, mechanical bull, any wussy could ride that. And I think I lasted, I want to say 3 seconds, maybe four. And that thing spit me off so fast and so furious that I thought, well, if that's a mechanical bull, maybe a real bull's even worse. Not to mention they'll run over and jump on you.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, I have a lot of respect for anybody riding a bull, whether it's mechanical or real, because that's no picnic.
Now, in my mind, if I were a young man, what I would do, I would not ride bulls, but I would be a bullfighter, because that looks like a lot of fun. That's what I would do. I would be a bullfighter.
Okay. So when he hooks you in the side and throws you up over his back, and
only if he can catch me. Only if he can catch me. In my mind, I'll be able to outrun him.
In your mind, that bull hasn't got a chance. In the bull's mind, I'm going to eat that guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I did grow up on a farm, so I have a little experience with these things. My brothers and I used to ride cows around. You know, get one of us up there, and somebody slapped the cow on the rear end.
Okay. So you never watched a cowboy movie then, did you? Because the cowboys, I think, always rode horses. I don't remember seeing any cowboys riding cows, even though they say cowboy. I think maybe where you got confused. Yeah. Cowboy.
Yeah. Well, you ride what you brung, man. You ride what's around.
Huh. Shoot. Yeah. Yep.
Well, this feels like probably a good place to wrap this
episode
up. I want to thank everybody for tuning in and putting up with our nonsense. And gosh, if you got good videos for Neil to watch in the doldrums of late winter in Minnesota or early spring, or I don't know, it could be summer with the way he's had his winter, but send him some videos or something to keep him entertained and keep him off the streets. And with that, we thank you, and we'll catch you on the next episode.